The following is for your ears only. Now in our 31st year, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Obama's Osama challenge, a year after his elimination, new controversy over bin Laden and the problems he left behind in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and beyond.
Reoccupied, what May Day demonstrations across the U.S. tell us about the prospects and power of avatars for the 99%.
Even worse than it looks, two experts on the political system agree on its dysfunction and how it can reform itself, maybe.
The Kovacs Legacy, a new exhibit celebrates TV comedy pioneer Ernie Kovacs, whose madcap creativity on screen still sets goals.
Mind, Body, and the Mainstream. Awards to Dr. Deepak Chopra and others mark new acceptance of meditation for healthcare.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of May 6th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda.
The goal that I set, to defeat al-Qaeda and deny it a chance to rebuild, is now within our reach.
Of course, I would have ordered taking out Osama bin Laden.
I said that I'd go after bin Laden if we had a clear shot at him, and I did. If there are others who have said one thing and now suggest they do something else, then I'd go ahead and let them explain it.
The first anniversary of President Obama's decision to launch the raid that killed Osama bin Laden was never likely to be overlooked, and particularly in an election year. But the problems that survived OBL's elimination were also on view. Obama made a secret trip to al-Qaeda's birthplace, Afghanistan, to shore up relations, but left confusion over just what the U.S. commitment would be after he keeps his promise to remove combat forces and over just how capable Afghan troops and governance will really be by then.
Going next door to Pakistan could not even be considered given a freeze in relations following the unannounced strike on bin Laden's lair there, subsequent mistaken attacks on Pakistani border forces, and civilian casualties from Obama-ordered drone strikes on other terror targets. Back in the U.S., Obama took flak for noting that Mitt Romney once questioned whether hunting Osama was worth the expense. And larger questions remain about his administration's expansion of counter-terror policies at the expense of civil liberties. To consider all these issues and more, for your ears only, we're joined by defense and intelligence expert James Kitfield, senior correspondent at the National Journal. Welcome to our program.
Happy to be here.
How important to U.S. security is protecting Afghanistan from weakened al-Qaeda when there are now so many Islamist offshoots around the world?
Well, I don't actually think al-Qaeda is the major threat to Afghanistan. It's primarily the Taliban now. But the Taliban has very close ties with al-Qaeda. It was the Taliban that ruled Afghanistan at the time of the 9/11 attacks. It was the Taliban that refused to give up bin Laden when President Bush offered to, offered to give them that out. So the Taliban remained. You know, we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan for about 5 years while we focused on Iraq, gave the Taliban and to some degree al-Qaeda the ability to reconstitute in Pakistan's tribal areas. And we've been dealing with the aftermath of that for quite a while and probably will be for the foreseeable future.
Of course, we're also negotiating with the Taliban or saying we're willing to. To what degree was Obama's message of accomplishment in Afghanistan undermined by the fact he had to come and go under cover of darkness, followed almost immediately by yet another suicide bombing in Kabul?
Well, I mean, I don't take much that he had to come in the middle of the night. It's just taking normal precautions in a place that is still quite violent and has an active insurgency that would love nothing better than to kill the President of the United States. One of the things we've learned from the treasure trove of intelligence we got from bin Laden was, one of his attacks that he proposed was an assassination of both President Obama and former CENTCOM commander General David Petraeus. So I think that's a normal precaution. I mean, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that Afghanistan is not a completed operation. There is the Taliban still are, they're still out there and they're terrorizing parts of the countryside. They faced some setbacks in the last 2 years after we surged forces and kicked them out of their traditional stronghold in Kandahar and Helmand. But they have sanctuary across the border with Pakistan. And as long as that's the case, it's very hard to sort of wipe them out or defeat them totally. And so we're trying to negotiate with them to see if there is, we can peel off a certain segment, and the remaining Taliban forces, you would hope, would be small enough for the expanded Afghan security forces to handle.
What is your best understanding of Obama's commitment to Afghanistan after the promised troop withdrawal in 2014?
They have not put any numbers on that, so it's still very vague, but they wanted to send a signal, and I think it's probably a good thing, that we're not going to do what happened in 1989, which was basically abandon Afghanistan to its own devices. It quickly, you know, after the Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan and left the country, we cut most of our aid and just turned our attention elsewhere at the end of the Cold War, leading to a civil war that led to the Taliban taking control of that country. So he's sending a message to the Afghanistan people that we're not going to do the same thing. There will be U.S. and allied support to help fund a rather robust Afghan security force. It's now going to be about 350,000 troops. They can't afford to keep that force, in equipment and training, et cetera. So we'll be helping them with that. We'll be helping them with a certain amount of trainers that will be behind to continue the training of the Afghan security forces to help them continually get better, and also to offer them enablers like advanced communications, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, air power, things they don't have much of right now, as well as retaining a residual counterterrorism group. Reed Special Forces will still be operating alongside their Afghan counterparts and targeting individuals, whether al-Qaeda or Taliban, that they see as a potential threat to the United States.
You mentioned Osama's letter envisioning an assassination of President Obama. What else did you find most important about the letters to and from bin Laden that the administration chose to release last week as part of the anniversary?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, he still had his hand in the operational direction of the organization. He was still in contact with the affiliates and offshoots that had sprung up in places like Somalia and Yemen. So he was a little bit more engaged than I think a lot of us had anticipated. Doesn't mean he was effectively engaged. There was probably a one-month lag as these messages he would send would get out to his couriers. And quite honestly, the entire organization and its affiliates have been under extreme pressure. So some of his plots to assassinate President Obama and do these other things were probably more fanciful than realistic. But it did show that he was still engaged, and also in the philosophical argument that they were going back and forth about this argument of do you support affiliates like the Pakistan Taliban. They were very critical of them because they were killing so many Muslims in Pakistan that bin Laden and his lieutenants thought was something that had cost them greatly in popularity during the Iraq War when Zarqawi was killing, massacring Muslims all over the place. And they thought that had hurt the brand.
You've written about Obama's continuation, even escalation, of some Bush domestic anti-terrorism measures that clearly help insulate him from Republican attacks. What does what we've learned in the last year about hunting down bin Laden tell us about the utility, especially of torture or lesser degrees of so-called enhanced interrogation? Were they really critical?
Well, I don't think so, and certainly the Obama administration doesn't think so. The very first action the president made as president was to ban enhanced interrogation techniques that the whole world saw as torture. We haven't done that, and in fact, hadn't done it much in the Bush's second term. But he also refused to prosecute any of those who were involved in that, so there was no legal precedent saying that the next president might not come in and say, hey, that was a good idea, let's use them. Some people will argue that there was information gotten from, Dick Cheney, former vice president, has argued that information that gotten from the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed coughed up the name of the courier that eventually led to bin Laden. It's impossible to know if that's exactly true because it's all classified, but it's certainly possible. I've talked to many seasoned interrogators who said that information could have been gotten by much more traditional means that didn't run counter to our values. So we're still having this debate.
Defense and intelligence expert James Kitfield is a senior correspondent at the National Journal.
Quote from the news, any way you look at it, it's worrisome. That was Wells Fargo chief economist John Sylvia on April's dismal employment report. Just 115,000 jobs created last month, down from the 154,000 in March, while 342,000 people dropped out of the labor force altogether, leaving only 63.6% of working age actually in the job market, lowest level since 1981.
Next, Reoccupied, a look at the May Day resurgence of demonstrators for the 99%. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I want to come to the United States to rest. I have not had a rest in 10 years. That was blind Chinese dissident lawyer Chen Guangcheng's plea to Congress via iPhone after threats to his family changed his mind about remaining in China following his escape from house arrest to days of tense asylum at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. Chinese officials later said he could apply for a visa to be a visiting scholar at New York University, and U.S. officials claimed the controversy did not impede negotiations for greater foreign investment in Chinese business and a greater shift in China's economy from exports to domestic consumption. Now this.
For all the people who thought we fell asleep this winter, loud and clear, once and for all, you see the work we put in across the wintertime. We built community. We built solidarity from workers to grassroots organizers to students to seniors to immigrants and to people around the world.
May Day, a traditional occasion for labor and left-wing solidarity around the world, last week gave the amorphous Occupy Wall Street movement and its many regional and global offshoots a chance to show they had only been dormant through the winter, not defunct. Enforced but effective austerity measures in the debt-ridden eurozone added even more passion to protests in Paris, Madrid, Barcelona, and London.
But even while absent from public view in the United States, Occupy continued to shape public dialogue and the political process, with the views and potential votes of the 99% never far from mine. To consider last week's Reoccupy activities, the phenomenon's inner workings, and long-term prospects for your ears only, we're joined by former student activist Todd Gitlin, now a distinguished professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. His new ebook is Occupy Nation: The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street, from IT Books HarperCollins. Welcome to our program.
Thanks very much.
There was a lot of other news last week about the bin Laden elimination, plans for Afghanistan, the blind Chinese dissident, and economic relations with Beijing. How well did you think the return of Occupy did in reasserting its presence and its perspectives?
Well, the good news is that it got us talking again about Occupy, as we are doing at this moment. The bad news is that it tends to be seen through the prism of crime events. So it's the arrests that become newsworthy and not the playfulness and not the big numbers who turned out tens of thousands in New York. And, you know, so mixed bag. But I'd say that, you know, it seems to be true that most of the activists in New York feel quite pleased that they're back. And now they face a lot of predicaments. And we'll see. I mean, this is a movement with many moving parts and lots of energies that sometimes are at cross purposes and sometimes line up vigorously, and you know, you never know what's coming down the pike.
What new tactics from Occupy activists do you expect to see this summer?
There are going to be a number of large coordinated rallies. Actually, later this month, there's going to be something at the Bank of America meeting, shareholder meeting in Charlotte, and then at the NATO meeting in Chicago later in May, and then, of course, at the political conventions. I think there's an ongoing debate about what part to play in the elections. I don't expect any clear decision, but there'll be a sort of imbroglio of a fight and a confusion about how to proceed. I think there'll be divisions between those who want to organize more or less in the system lobbying and campaigning, and those who want to emphasize encampments and face-to-face engagement, and so it will go.
Occupy prides itself on apparent leaderlessness, but clearly there are people at the core with the energy and organizing skills required to keep the process going. Give us an idea of who impressed you most and why.
Well, actually, I was thinking about this in the run-up from the news from China, because one of the more extraordinary people of quite a number of extraordinary people I've met in the course of working on my book is a veteran, one of the leaders of the Tiananmen movement from 1989, who fled China and came here and became a computer businessman. His name is Shen Tong, and he's extremely lucid and quite in harmony with the main spirit of the movement. I could name quite a number of other people. Suffice to say that it's not true that there are no leaders. There are many leaders, and they prove themselves in the course of action. That is, they demonstrate leadership capacity. I think what we'll start to see is more crystallized, more definite networks that will be more visible. They'll be the people who last, and we'll see them. I've been put in conference calls with, for example, people who are organizing the Bank of America protest later this month, whose names I don't even know, but clearly they're quite together. They what I mean is that they think strategically and they also think energetically and creatively. So there are hundreds of such people in this movement.
There has been talk, hope in some quarters, fear in others, of an Occupy general strike. How do you see the prospects for that, the arguments for and against it?
Well, I think they made a mistake, actually, and there are people at the heart of the movement who think so, too, in declaring that the May Day event would be a general strike, because then you set yourself up for the appearance of defeat, of failure. What they should have done is said, I think, we are reminding America that the 99% are still here. General strikes can't be organized from outsider. And, there's a certain sentimental attachment to the ideal of the general strike. I was at a meeting where somebody said, when I hear the words general strike, I see the face of God. But that doesn't make it happen. So, once again, there's a scramble for imagery and sort of a way of naming what it is you're doing. And I have a fair amount of confidence that their collective creativity will find other ways of naming what they do from here on.
Well, that's tactics and to a degree strategy. What about the essential critique that Occupy needs to generate more specific goals to have a real impact on the economic or political system?
Well, there are a number of people in the movement who agree with that proposition and quite a number who disagree. The ones who agree, I think, tend to focus on the goal of driving money out of politics and reversing the tide of plutocratic domination of our politics, which has been in the works for decades. But those who disagree continue to be there. And, I think they will all have their way in that there is likely to be some entity, it may or may not be called Occupy Wall Street, that proceeds toward a more focused approach to reforms. And there will be those who disdain that project and go on doing what they're doing now. And, it's beyond me to anticipate which is going to be stronger.
Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. His new ebook is Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street from IT Books HarperCollins. It'll come out in paper later in the year.
And here's a quote from the news. They are absolutely going to hand over power. I think they can't wait. That was Senator John Kerry, seconding assurances by Egypt's interim military rulers to pass control by the end of June, despite continuing criticism of their failure to stop fatal violence against pro-democracy demonstrators.
Next, another critique of the system from the belly of the beast, for your ears only. With more for your ears only, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. If personnel is policy, his message to the pro-family community, drop dead. That was a tweet by the Conservative American Family Association's Brian Fisher on the Romney campaign's hiring of an openly gay, Bush-era foreign policy expert, Richard Grenell. Barred from speaking on a conference call he himself had arranged, Grenell resigned, and Romney faced new charges of political cowardice. Now this.
Several months ago, you all voted to cut $4 billion out of this slush fund when we passed the payroll tax credit bill. So to accuse us of wanting to gut women's health is absolutely not true.
It may be a slush fund to him, but it's survival to women.
Recent differences between House Speaker John Boehner and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi over how to pay for the mutually agreed goal of low-cost college loans were only the latest example of partisan congressional gridlock, and hardly the most toxic. As the title of a new book about American politics proclaims, quote, "It's even worse than it looks." The subtitle specifies how the American constitutional system collided with the new politics of extremism.
The volume itself, from Basic Books, is slim, less than 230 pages, but backed by decades of insight from opposite ends of the Washington think tank world. The co-authors are Thomas Mann of the moderate liberal Brookings Institution and Norman Ornstein of the proudly conservative American Enterprise Institute. And to talk more about their consensus on the problem and possible solutions, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Norm Ornstein on the line again. Welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
You've said some of your colleagues at AEI are not happy about the book's conclusion that while there's plenty of blame to go around, a preponderance falls on today's Republican Party. State your case.
Well, I really do believe that while no party is an angel in this process, and we do have two parliamentary-style parties now, in a parliamentary system where you have a majority and a minority that are internally cohesive and oppose each other, there's a real difference in orientation between the two. The Republican Party has become an insurgent outlier. It's much more vehement in its opposition. And if you use the familiar, if tired, old football field analogy, over the last 30 years or so, both parties have moved towards their bases, but the Democrats have moved from their proverbial 40-yard line to about their 25. And President Obama, by the way, is much closer to the 40. The Republican Party has moved substantially behind its own goalpost. And it's not just ideology. It's also an inclination, almost a tribal politics, to vote against in unison anything, not because of the particular ideas, but because of who's espousing them. So if Bill Clinton was for it when he was president, they were against it. But even more now, if Barack Obama is for it, they're against it.
To what degree is the problem in Washington inevitable, given a newly energized, organized, and financed conservative grassroots constituency that's capable of challenging even the most veteran GOP legislators who stray from ideological purity on even a single issue?
That's a really good point, and that certainly a part of the reason that we've gotten into this dynamic is that we have politics driven by the ideological extremes and the bases, but the conservative groups have become much more organized and much stronger and much more willing to use their leverage. So, you know, frankly, having been immersed in the halls of Congress for many decades, four or more, actually, I know a lot of Republicans, many of them pretty conservative, whose orientation is problem-solving. But when you start to move in that direction, you risk having your head cut off. Now, obviously, we saw that in the last election cycle when Bob Bennett, a senator from Utah, one of the five most conservative senators in voting record, was denied even the chance to run for re-election because he had done the sin of sleeping with the enemy, working on a health care plan with a liberal Democrat, Ron Wyden. And now we see, heading into primaries next week, that Richard Lugar, one of the strongest and most respected senators really of the last 50 years, also pretty conservative, is hanging on by a thread in a primary challenge from a Tea Party candidate because he's been too bipartisan.
Well, you can't keep those people from voting, and now, thanks to the Supreme Court, you can't limit those who want to finance their political campaigns. But one answer, you say, is mobilizing the middle, getting more moderates to vote in primaries and general elections. Talk about some of the techniques you think might be effective.
If I could do one thing, if I could wave my magic wand and bring about one change, it would be to give us something like the Australian system of mandatory attendance at the polls. You don't have to vote in Australia, but if you don't show up and you can cast a ballot for none of the above, you face a fine of roughly $15. You can write a letter explaining why you couldn't make it, too. But what's happened over the last six decades or so that the system's been in place is that Australians vote by 95% or more, and it's not that you can just feel good because more people are voting. What the politicians in Australia will tell us is if they know that their base is going to be at the polls and almost full numbers, and the other side's base will as well, you don't focus so much on them. You focus on those voters in the middle. Different set of issues. They don't talk much about guns or gays in their election campaigns. They talk about the economy and education and jobs. And they don't use the shrill language because that turns off the voters in the middle. Now, we're not going to do that. Mandatory anything doesn't work very well. So we fall back on other things. My fallback in this case is let's do a lottery, a Mega Millions. Your ticket for the lottery, you can win a huge sum of money, is your vote stub. I think that might increase our turnout by focusing on incentives instead of mandates by a very substantial amount. And then if you throw in things like open primaries, which we're now doing in California and some other states, you can expand the electorate and give more of a voice to the center. The fact remains that more Americans are in the center than anywhere else, even though the center has virtually collapsed in our national and state politics.
Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute is co-author with the Brookings Institution's Thomas Mann of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, new from Basic Books.
Quote from the news, this time people are willing to die. That was Hanan Ashwari of the Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee on growing potentially violent demonstrations supporting at least 1,500 Palestinian hunger strikers under administrative detention without formal charges or trial by Israel in what some call the Battle of the Empty Stomachs.
Next, celebrating a pioneer of TV comedy, Ernie Kovacs, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this news quote, not a fit person to exercise the stewardship of a major international company. That was the conclusion about media mogul Rupert Murdoch of a British parliamentary investigation into illegal phone hacking and payoffs to police at some of his UK properties. There followed a 19-cent rise in News Corp stock as shareholders saw improved chances for management change. Now this. The harpist and composer Robert Maxwell is famous to some for the pop hits Ebb Tide and Shangri-La. But for others of us, his most beloved contribution is an instrumental piece called Solfeggio, at least as played by a trio of gorillas in overcoats and derby hats, as a regular feature of Ernie Kovacs' television shows in the 1950s and early 60s. And that was hardly the most madcap facet of Kovacs on TV. There was the lisping, gin-sipping poet Percy Dovetonsils, a mustachioed Lena Queen of the Jungle, that was Kovacs himself, beer cans buried in milk bottles, hidden in melons cut down from paper trees, and a studio stage so tilted that water on camera seemed to pour at a 45-degree angle.
Kovacs was a pioneer of TV comedy, so prolific and creative that 50 years since his death in an auto accident, he still inspires and instructs TV comics of today. An exhibit that celebrates that work with wife and co-star Edie Adams is on view through May 27th at New York's Museum of the Moving Image, curated by film and TV historian Ben Modell, who also created a 6-disc Kovacs box set. And to talk about both projects, Kovacs and Adams, both personally and professionally, for your ears only, Ben Modell joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Happy to be here.
Where did Kovacs get his start and his inspiration for using the new technology of television while making fun of its then fairly stodgy conventions?
This is one of the things we were trying to figure out at the panel event that we had at the Museum of the Moving Image last Friday. And, you know, you can chart the arc of how he got into television, but because he started in television when television itself was beginning, it's really hard to say where it all came from. He had been interested in theater when he was in high school and shortly after studied acting for a year or two. and a few years later got into radio and was writing a regular column in Trenton. It was a very popular comic DJ from 1941 to 1950, and then got a job initially announcing on WPTV in Philadelphia, and eventually wound up in front of the camera, and then to a morning wake-up show that predated the Today Show, which actually, when the Today Show went national, it knocked Ernie's show off the air. But he was basically filling 2 or 2.5 hours of morning daytime television, completely unscripted, 5 days a week. But his innate instinct for the visual and trying to see what you could do because you were on television just came right out of the gate. He hadn't done any stage, you know, he wasn't a stand-up comic or anything like that, but it just seems to have just been there. The way when you see Buster Keaton's first films, you're astounded at his almost instant grasp of film language.
How did the Nairobi Trio come to be, with the cigar-chomping leader ever more infuriated by one of the other two endlessly playing drums on his head?
In the early 50s, he heard that, and that's what immediately flashed across his mind, is this image of three people in gorilla suits playing music. But in that very, you know, this is something that was, again, mentioned at the panel, it's the one time you see somebody in a gorilla mask doing something very subtle. You know, this very slow burn, like Edgar Kennedy, sort of slowly turning and reacting. We don't know where these eyes, they just happen.
And we gather that behind some of those gorilla masks, besides Kovacs and Adams, were often even more celebrated faces.
Well, that's true. In later years, when they would perform it live, people like Frank Sinatra would play the ape with the mallets as a surprise thing at events. And the last version that was taped in 1961, the one that most people have seen, is Ernie is in the middle. Actress Jolene Brand is on the piano, and Jack Lemmon is the one with the mallet.
The story behind the exhibit and behind the box set you created was how the late Edie Adams saved so much of her husband's archive from extinction, and not on the cheap. Talk about the fate his work faced in TV network hell and how she stepped in.
Well, there is no value or to a lot of people in television to hold on to these things. And it wasn't just, you know, Ernie was didn't have a gigantic following, but there are stories of the tape masters of The Tonight Show and other well-known programs that were just taped over because, well, these have run, we're never going to need this again, but 2-inch tape is expensive and we need this, you know, for weather footage. And so the videotapes from Ernie's shows from the late 50s and early 60s, when tape came in, I think at some point in the mid to late 60s, because Edie, she had a great relationship with the people on the crew, and somebody, a cameraman or somebody behind the scenes at ABC called Edie and said, "Edie, you better get over here. They are erasing Ernie's shows." And she did, and got, you know, whatever she needed to get together financially and acquired as much of the tapes as she could. But she was saving things from the very beginning as well. There are hundreds of audio transcription records that she had made during the run of Kovacs Unlimited, Ernie's show on CBS from 1952 to 54. Initially, she had them made because she had not done much pop singing and was doing that on the show and needed to hear herself. And then somewhere along the line realized, gosh, nobody is saving this show, and it's really great material, and just kept having the records made. So while there's only one Kinescope, which is a 16-millimeter film shot off a television set of that entire two-year show, there are, you know, like I said, several dozen of these audio transcription records, and the sound quality is amazing.
Film and TV historian Ben Modell created the Ernie Kovacs Collection, a 6-DVD box set, and guest curated the Ernie Kovacs and Edie Adams exhibit through May 27th at New York's Museum of the Moving Image. More information at movingimage.us, also erniekovacs.com and edieadams.com. Now, more Nairobi. Next, mainstream meditation for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. They just don't look like girls I see walking down the street and stuff. That was 14-year-old Julia Bloom, whose Change.org petition drew 46,000 supporters asking 17 magazine to run at least one non-Photoshop spread each issue to avoid unrealistic standards of beauty for adolescent girls and boys. She met the editor but got no promises. Now this.
Meditation is the natural tendency of your mind when you're really doing nothing. If you sit down, close your eyes, and do absolutely nothing, after a while, your mind will settle down and go to its natural state, which is one of silence. So it happens spontaneously when we are not trying to do anything.
To many, meditation is a mystery and maybe a bit unnerving. To others, the notion of doing absolutely nothing, as explained by best-selling author and wellness guru Deepak Chopra, seems a merciful respite from the daily flurry of activity and thought. But a growing array of clinical research indicates that meditation can have significant health benefits, especially for the sick and those facing life's end.
One by one, more hospitals are integrating those trained in the practice of meditation as chaplains and aides, helping patients cope with anxieties, discomfort, difficult decisions, and the inevitable. The New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care has been helping to lead the way in collaboration with mainstream medicine, and last week gave its own special awards to Dr. Chopra and others involved with healthcare and well-being. To talk about it all for Your Ears Only, joining us now is the center's co-founder, Koshin Paley Ellison. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, tell us about the increasingly accepted benefits of meditation in health and medical situations.
Well, there's an incredible body of research over the last 20 years, and through neuroscience and also through people like Jon Kabat-Zinn, who have been studying mindfulness-based stress reduction, about the just very practical, grounded, that, you know, having time to reflect and come back to your breath actually lowers your blood pressure, helps cope with anxiety, and actually really decreases lots of illnesses, especially gastrointestinal, and many, many ways that us in a modern society, we really forget how simple it is to actually come back and feel our breath in our body and how that ripples through our whole lives and can change us physically, emotionally, and we could even say spiritually.
Is meditation as easy to learn as Dr. Chopra suggests? It can be difficult to quiet the mind.
It is. It's the simplest instruction to just follow your breath, to come back to yourself. And in some ways, that's the most difficult part of it, too. And that's why, as Deepak and many of us know, that we need to sit with others and to have some support. So that's why there's mindfulness groups and meditation groups and Zen groups, where it's good to sit with other people because it is challenging to do it on our own. And it feels good to be with others.
How do your student chaplains approach the majority of patients in mainstream medical facilities who are not already Buddhists or Zen devotees? How do they basically sell this as a useful service or approach to health and well-being?
They don't try to sell it. But I think what they do try to do is that they're available to anyone. And to be with, we cover, you know, thousands and care for thousands of people every year. And most of them are not Buddhist. One of the important things, I think by 2030, less than half of the country will be Judeo-Christian. So that we're kind of facing a time where things are really changing and people are much more open to other ways of connecting to themselves. And I think that has to do with neuroscience and other research and mainstream that has happened. So what they do is offer to be with people with their own presence and are not coming in to lay a trip on anyone, but they're coming in to find out, how can I be with you in an intimate way? And sometimes meditation is an incredible tool to to help someone who is very anxious, to help someone who's about to have surgery. They've done research studies about people using meditation before surgery, and people do much better. Cardiac patients as well.
What do you think it will take to gain a more general acceptance in the mainstream medical community?
I think that more research needs to be done, that we live in a world where science is the most important. So to have really great studies funded, studying the effects of meditation on all stages of medical treatment. And I think that's a key piece. And also I think that the work of Deepak and others like him are really widening the reach, popularizing these ideas in an incredible way so that people are not, it's not really New Age anymore. And so it's allowing people to realize, oh, this is, you know, really helpful. So I think that the more that the doctors and administrators realize that there'll be a greater impact, because my experience is the nurses and social workers already get it. And so we need to really work with the doctors and doing training for doctors beginning in medical school.
Koshin Paley Ellison is the co-founder of the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. You can learn more about it at zencare.org.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and feedburner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email me at davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at Hanger Studio. With interns Gene Moon and Rachel Murray, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a production of the nonprofit Gatewave.org radio reading service with support from the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and Condop since 1983. Learn more at acam.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Rachel Murray. The big story that week last year, of course, was the death of Osama bin Laden, whose continuing fallout for President Obama and the wider world we've already considered. Also notable in that show was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian's take on the lessons for Obama and the rest of us from the life of Abraham Lincoln. From our May 8th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
I feel that Lincoln is so relevant to our society today, not that you can pick him up and say, well, what would Lincoln think about abortion rights, or what would Lincoln think about a stimulus package? No, that's not the issue. Lincoln's life illuminates persistent questions of American history. Obviously, the question of race, the question of the role of the government, the question of the role of presidential leadership. He ends up as the great emancipator, no question about it. But he doesn't just get there in a straight line.
Despite the bulging shelf of books about Abraham Lincoln, many of them quite excellent, he concedes, Columbia University professor Eric Foner thought he might have something new and useful to say about Lincoln in historical context, a master politician both changing with and changing the thinking of his times. Critics and other experts agreed. In February, the latest of his 20-plus books, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery from W.W. Norton, beat more than 100 other entries for the Lincoln Prize. Last month, it won the Pulitzer Prize for History.
Foner was my college classmate at Columbia, a student leader, as well as a leading student back then, and I'm pleased to have him on the line again now to talk about the book and Lincoln's lessons for today, For Your Ears Only. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Nice to talk to you as always, David.
Your research confirmed that Lincoln was long and deeply opposed to slavery, but not without traces of the racism towards Negroes that was common in his early environs. Talk about some of the most telling evidence on that.
Well, Lincoln, you know, as I said, shared many of the prejudices growing up of the world that he lived in. He was born in Kentucky, a slave state, grew up in southern Indiana, and then moved to southern or central Illinois. These were areas populated by people from the South. There was no slavery in Indiana and Illinois, but the people who had moved from Kentucky or Virginia or Tennessee brought their prejudices with them. I think the evidence on Lincoln in the early days is more by omission. Lincoln never spoke out against the very harsh anti-black laws that Illinois passed. You know, Illinois barred black people from even entering the state in the 1850s. Lincoln didn't take up the cases of fugitive slaves or blacks being unjustly treated in Illinois in his law career. And then when accused in the 1850s by his opponent, Stephen Douglas, of favoring, quote-unquote, Negro equality, which was sort of the nuclear weapon of politics back then, he denied it, absolutely. He said, no, I do not favor Negro equality. He said, I'm opposed to slavery, and I believe black people are entitled to natural rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, but I don't think they should vote. I don't think they should hold office. His solution, so to speak, in those in the earlier part of his career to the question of slavery was to free slaves and encourage them to leave the country, go somewhere else. In other words, he didn't really see black people at that time as an intrinsic part of American life.
On the other hand, as slavery and its abolition became defining issues of the North-South divide, you say he made a point of surrounding himself with proponents of opposing opinions. Talk about that.
Well, particularly when he was president, you know, I think Lincoln did not surround himself with yes men. Too many presidents just put people in who tell them what they already want to hear. I came to be very impressed with his open-mindedness, his intellectual curiosity. He didn't mind criticism. He met with people who were much more radical on the slavery issue than he was, abolitionists, radical Republicans, and he welcomed criticism. He welcomed different ideas.
You say he was not afraid of changing his views and his policies as the situation required. What were the factors that finally moved Lincoln to the Emancipation Proclamation and his final views on where freed slaves would fit into the American society?
Well, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation, as Lincoln himself said, was determined by numerous events, numerous things. There was the failure to win the war on the basis that it had begun, in other words, just a war to restore the antebellum status quo. There was the pressure from abolitionists. There was the fact that slaves themselves were running away to Union lines. Whatever the, you know, at the beginning, Lincoln said this is only a war for the Union, not to attack slavery. But slaves said, forget it. If there's an army present, that destroys the power of the slave owners, and we're running to get refuge there. And that kind of forced slavery onto the national agenda. And I think Lincoln, and then there was the need for black manpower. By 1862, enlistment in the army was waning. Blacks were at first not allowed into the army, but by then you needed every man you could get. And all those factors, I think, propelled Lincoln down the road toward the Emancipation Proclamation, which announced, it didn't free all the slaves in one stroke of the pen, but it announced that henceforth the abolition of slavery would be an equal purpose of the war, as well as preserving the Union. So it fundamentally changed the nature of the Civil War and basically of American society. By the end of his life, Lincoln had been thinking seriously about the role of blacks in the post-Civil War world. There was no longer talk of colonization, of sending them out of the country. He didn't reach any definitive conclusion. Of course, he's assassinated, you know, just at the beginning of his what would have been his second term. We don't know where he would have ended up, but at the very end of his life, he's saying he favors limited black suffrage in the South. Some more educated blacks and the soldiers would get the right to vote. And so he had moved very far from his earlier, more prejudiced views of these things.
Much has been made of Barack Obama's aligning himself with Lincoln at the start of his presidential run, but some early liberal supporters see him evolving in an opposite direction, following political realities to assume more conservative positions of President Bush on Guantanamo, Afghanistan, Homeland Security, more recent compromises on budget cuts and tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans. What's your view on that?
Lincoln and Obama lived in very different worlds. I think the key point is Lincoln was pushed toward more radical views by a very aroused social movement, abolitionism, radical republicanism. This was an important part of Northern society. It wasn't a majority by any means, but it represented an important part of the public sentiment at that time. The pressures on Obama are all coming from the other direction. The mobilized people in the country appear to be the Tea Party, the right wing, the people who want these kind of cutbacks that you referred to. Obama is not being pushed by his left wing. The labor movement is much weaker than it used to be, etc. So I think, you know, all presidents, in a sense, have to deal with the political climate that that exists. Now, on the other hand, they also can help to shape it. And Lincoln, I think, did a lot, as I try to argue in my book, to shape public opinion on slavery, not just to respond to it. And I think maybe Obama can be faulted for failing to get out and lead on these questions of whatever it is, Guantanamo, civil liberties, budget, etc.
Eric Foner is DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University and author most recently of The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery from W.W. Norton, winner of this year's Lincoln Prize and the Pulitzer Prize for History.
Lessons from Lincoln, from our May 8th, 2011 broadcast. In a recent NPR interview, Professor Foner said he'd like to see contemporary candidates concede, like Lincoln, quote, "I have changed my mind. We don't seem to allow our politicians to do that anymore." Former student activist Foner was also at Columbia's May Day proceedings last week, comparing Occupy Wall Street with the populist movement of the 1890s, also short on specific demands. "The job of protesters is to put issues out on the public agenda and change public sentiment," Foner said. If public sentiment changes, political action will follow. I'm Rachel Murray. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Edie Adams putting comedy aside for a lovely song. In fact, the last song in the last episode of TV's Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz Comedy Hour in 1960.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's